everybody. I would like to welcome you all back again to MHPN's webinar. Tonight's topic is supporting the mental health of older people living in the community. I would first of all like to welcome 493 participants so far. We've had 1,400 people registered, so that number will climb during the evening. It is also important to say that MHPN wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respect to the elders past, present and future for the memories, the traditions, the culture and hopes of Indigenous Australia, particularly on this day. My name is Michael Murray. I'm a GP from Townsville. I have a special interest in mental health and I'm also a medical educator. We have a very talented panel here tonight and I shall go through their names. The first person I'd like to introduce is Sharon Lee Hazel, who is from the ACT. Sharon, can I just ask you, how did you first become interested in being an advocate for carers and for the elderly?
Well, Michael, I was actually a carer for my mother, who had bipolar disorder, and my husband's mother has Alzheimer's. Right. So, I have, since my mother's death, which was about 6 years ago, you have more time when you're not in a caring role. And I've been able to take some of the issues that I came across to various tables, particularly in the ACT. So I'm a carers rep for Carers ACT. I'm on advisory boards and such. And I'm also now doing a PhD at the ANU on older people and chronic mental illness and their carers, and looking at services and support that will meet their needs.
Great. And you find that you're being listened to and being respected for your opinion?
Yes. It does. I think that the culture's changing. I think sometimes there was room made at the table for consumers and carers. And I think now people are very used to having us at the table. And yes, So the conversations can be very, very good.
Right. Thank you very much for attending and agreeing to be on the panel tonight. Next, I would just like to introduce Associate Professor Morten Rowland. Morten, you're very welcome here tonight.
Thanks, Michael.
Can you just give us a brief overview of your expertise in this area, please?
I'm a GP currently working in Melbourne. I have been a rural GP previously. And I'm currently the chair of the General Practice Mental Health Standards Collaborative and on the MHPN board. I have particular interest in mental health and particularly around keeping people within their communities and working within the community for their mental health. I have an interest in aged care. I visit six different aged care facilities around my local area and provide that sort of service also.
That's great, Morten. Thank you very much. You sound like a very well-rounded GP and educator. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And next I'd like to introduce Julie Bajic. Julie is a psychologist who joins us from New South Wales. Julie, can you give us an overview of your expertise in this area, please?
Good evening, Michael. Yes, my name is Julie. I'm a psychologist in private practice in Sydney. I'm also completing a PhD looking at the impact of mental health in older people on the aged care workforce. I visit 48 facilities in Sydney, Central Coast and Newcastle, and I work particularly with people who are transitioning from independent living, moving into supported accommodation. I also chair the New South Wales Psychology and Ageing Interest Group, the Australian Psychological Society.
Could you explain the organisation WiseCare to us briefly, please?
Oh, yes. So I have a team of psychologists who support me in delivering treatment to older people who move into care. So what we do is we run wellness programs as part of the admission into residential care. In my experience, I found that it's not just about treating the individual and their transition. It is also about supporting the families, educating staff, and supporting the wider community.
So taking the healthy home model rather than the illness model.
That's right, yes.
Great. That's really good. Thanks very much, Julie. And last but certainly not least, I'd like to welcome Henry Brody, a psychiatrist from New South Wales. Hello, Henry, you're very welcome. Can you tell us how you first became interested in aged psychiatry?
Oh, I became involved in setting up what's now Alzheimer's Australia. First in New South Wales and then nationally and then internationally. I moved full-time into psychogeriatrics in 1990. But currently I work at the Prince of Wales Hospital in Sydney as a psychogeriatrician and I head up a memory disorders clinic. And I spend probably a bit more than half my time at the University of New South Wales where I'm a professor of ageing and mental health and also director of the Dementia Collaborative Research Centre and co-director of the Centre for Healthy Brain Ageing. I'm also involved with the International Psychogeriatric Association, where I'm the current president. I see patients, adult patients. I go to people's homes and I go to nursing homes. And I used to look after inpatients as well, but I've stopped doing that lately.
That's great, Henry. You sound like a very, very, very well-rounded psychiatrist.
Thank you.
What do you prefer doing the most?
I quite like the home visits. I mean, I like the research a lot, and that's where I've really put my energies in. I used to be director of our department at the hospital, but I stood down from that about 2 or 3 years ago and have moved full-time in university with a conjoined hospital appointment. So I love the research, but I would not like to give up seeing patients. And since I gave up being the director of the department, I've had time to go and do home visits, which I think really leads a whole new dimension of seeing what happens with people. You get quite different view from having them come into your consulting room.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yep.
Thank you very much. Now we have a poll that's running this evening. We have 622 participants on board. Out of 1,400, we expect the other 800 to catch up. I did notice that somebody had written that if MHPN had been in the Eurovision Song Contest, we would have gotten 12 votes. So can you all quickly vote and just show us where you are coming from? It will be interesting to see if we have anybody internationally. Yes, there's one. Good, so that gives us a fair breakdown so far. Right, okay, so we're running about 2-1 between metro and regional. Probably the rural would make up and make that even Stephen, really, with that one international person still hanging in there. We might just close that poll now and move on with tonight's presentation. And we will just move firstly to Sharon. But first I'll just go over the ground rules. Just remember that when you are posting, all attendees, be respectful of other participants and panelists and behave as if this were a face-to-face activity. Post your comments and questions for panelists in the general chat box. If you get into trouble and you need help for technical issues, go into the technical help chat box. And please keep all the comments on topic if you can. If you'd like to hide the chat, remember you can click the small down arrow at the top of the chat box. Your feedback is extremely important to MHPN, and at the end of the session, I will remind you of that again, and there is a short exit survey which will appear as a pop-up when you exit the webinar. And now, as we head towards our first speaker. We have 640 people online. So the NA outcomes for tonight are three, and through an exploration of Eddie's experience, you will have had Eddie's story. The webinar will provide participants with the opportunity to firstly recognize the key principles of the featured disciplines approach in screening and assessing the mental health of older people living in the community. Secondly, understand how different practitioners can intervene to support older people living in the community, thereby improving mental health outcomes. And lastly, to identify challenges to and opportunities for collaboration that may emerge as practitioners from different disciplines working together. To achieve the first learning outcome, we'll move to the first part of our presentation, and we will now hear from Sharon.
Thanks, Michael. The first thing that I really picked up from the scenario was that Tom wasn't aware, I think, that he was a carer for quite some time. So early in the story, you could see that in the scenario that Eddie had been a manager before his retirement. He'd been active in the community after his retirement with his wife Mary. And it wasn't until around Mary's illness and death that he started to show some signs. But this might not have been picked up by his immediate family straight away. And so, and at the same time, his son and daughters and other family would also be grieving the loss of Mary as well. And so they'd be also going through their own issues around that time. So so that brings me to the carers don't always know they are carers, and also changes in the older person go undetected by the family. And it isn't until sometimes the matters have become quite serious that the family really starts to understand what's going on. And this is mainly because the person has been independent potentially for quite some time. They are the parent in this case. And so you've got that parent-child relationship. And it takes a while for older adult children to take on their parents like a responsibility to ask them what's going on. And so you can see in this scenario too that Tom was fearful of ridicule or making his father angry or upset by posing some probably useful questions to his dad. And so there's a potential for conflict then between the older person and the carer. And but there's also that conflict, that potential there for conflict between, in this case, Tom and his sisters, because the sisters aren't living, not that this has come up much in the scenario, but the sisters are living away from that area, don't see their father regularly. And so sometimes the older person can put on quite a different persona on the phone to their other children. And so there is that potential for conflict. And also between the carer and the medical team. And I'll talk about a bit more about this soon. So what does the older person with a mental health condition need? And from my experience, they really need that sense of dignity and control over the situation. They are feeling confused anyway. If they are having maybe they're depressed or anxious, or maybe they do have early signs of dementia, and but they still want to keep their independence for quite some time. So access to services and support is really essential. That they have the right physical and mental health services that they need. Home and personal care, disability aid, that they still have some social outlets, and that their housing is adequate for their needs as well. But sometimes I found that old persons underestimate their needs to their family because they either don't want to be a burden, or they and they want to retain their independence. I think we can all understand that too, that they have been their own person for a long time, maybe 70, 80 years, And so it is a difficult time for them. But there is also a burden for the carer. First of all, as we can see in this scenario with Tom, he would have had also his own stresses, certainly emotional, as he saw his father deteriorate, but perhaps also financial. And this can happen if the carer has to spend more time looking after the older person, maybe skipping work, or they need to go to work, so they're worried about not being with the person they're caring with. And so their mental health can also suffer as a result. And the other thing that is apparent, I think, in this scenario too, is carers don't always know what questions to ask, either of the person that they're caring for or of the medical profession. And so sometimes it takes them a while to really get around to the questions they want to ask, and it's great when the health professionals can step in and anticipate what they need to know. Oh, I just clicked the wrong thing. So what does the carer need? They need to be aware of their rights and responsibilities, and they also need to have a sense of control and understanding of the situation. This can come about with some perhaps some education and discussions with teams and support groups. There needs to be appropriate and open communication between the older person that they're caring for, the rest of the family, and also with the health professionals. And it'd be great if the health professionals can also assess the carer need, work out who the carer is. And this might be that the consumer will tell the health professional who they think their carer is, or it might be just quite apparent from the situation. They probably or possibly need financial support, and they need to know, sometimes they don't know, if they haven't been a carer before, that there are organisations that can help them, that can provide counselling. And so some final things I got from this scenario too that I consider a real issue is around discharge planning. This can be a very stressful time for the person and the older person and the family if it's not done correctly. And I think it should start from when a person's first admitted to hospital. And in this case too, this brings me to the physical versus mental health care. Because Eddie was actually admitted for a physical illness, he was only in there for 3 days, but it doesn't look like in the discharge planning or during his hospital stay, perhaps he didn't have the mental health assessment that he needed. And I often found that with my own mother, if she went into hospital with a physical ailment, that her and mum had clear mental health issues with her bipolar disorder, that they were treated rather separately, and this wasn't always helpful on discharge. The other thing too is the impact of change on the older person. And so, you know, there might be the changes in medication. They might have to experience that. They might have injuries like Eddie did, illness, grief, loss. This all seemed to really affect my mother and other older people that I've known. And it's sometimes very hard, I found, for the family or the health professionals that we talk with to really know what was the cause for some of what were quite depressive signs or anxiety. And so it's quite a tangled web that has to be worked out. So I think I'll leave it there, because there's a lot of lot more to be said. And so, Michael, back to you.
Thank you very much, Sharon. I'm very much looking forward to your PhD, and I'm sure you'll be coming back to MHPN as a proper doctor rather than a bachelor doctors. And now we'll move on to Morten. Morten's presentation from the general practice perspective.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks, Sharon. That was a really good summary and start off. I guess the main things that I wanted to bring up was what the GP can bring to this process. Essentially, the GP should be in the position to be the coordinator of the information and the primary point of contact, both for the patient primarily, but also for the family as well. The number of times that I get information from family members and relatives of and friends for that matter about individuals and their concerns, the difficulty is what can you actually do with that, and we might touch on that a bit later. It is important for somebody to be able to try to facilitate the discussion between the patient and the family. The patient may not know how to start that conversation. The family may not know how to start that conversation. They may still be grieving over their mother's loss, and now all these other things are being brought up after the admission to hospital. All of these things make life difficult for the family and also the patient. It's really important for the GPs to also remember that we are actually dealing with a family, and that's not always easy. At the bottom of it, we as GPs need to try and exclude and classify the various medical issues that might be going on with this patient. Not everybody who is confused is depressed. Not everybody who is confused has a brain tumour or things like that. We need to sort out what is happening. The number of people who I have seen who've had long-term battles with being depressed and turn out to have things like hypothyroidism and things like that, which come on very slowly and are easily missed if you don't keep them in mind and keep looking for them. In terms of the medical issues, and often with the mental health issues as well, the GP is often the person who needs to commence the treatments of various types, and that may be with counselling or it may be medication, and that may be in association with other services, whether that be in the mental health arena or in the more physical arena. And sometimes we actually end up being the advocate for those patients into the health system. Again, the number of times that you have to ring to facilitate an appointment, particularly in the situation of older people, because it is very hard for them to sometimes negotiate through the switchboards of public hospitals, then the outpatient departments, then trying to speak to the admitting people, and then trying to speak to, the list goes on. And sometimes they do need somebody to cut through the red tape, and most GPs will do that if at all possible. If, and this is another big if the patients tell them that they're having difficulty. We aren't mind readers, you can sometimes assume, but it's better to work with the person to help them to come to terms with what needs to happen and also what can happen for them. On occasions, the other part of our advocacy role is to try and break down some of the barriers. One side of the family is not talking to the other side, or a friendship has broken down over the back fence or something like that, and we sometimes have to get involved in that as well. Similarly, it does take a bit to work through what might in fact be going on with this person. It is not only some of the big things, but in my experience, it can also be big things to them which may seem small to us. The fact that their cat is sick, or they are no longer able to afford going to the club or something like that. All of these things are matters that we have to look at and keep in mind. All of this is on the basis of a legal background, and there are obviously some definite legalities that you need to keep in mind. There are privacy issues, confidentiality issues, and in amongst all of that is trying to weigh up the line between what is safe for the patient to stay at home when they wish to, and when is the time when it's no longer safe and they're putting themselves at risk. And that's a very hard conversation that we sometimes have to have. We can't force them to leave their homes, and we have to try and assist them. But you actually almost have to be the voice of reason in some times like this. And it is also important that we appropriately discuss matters with the other carers, the other professionals who are involved, as well as the individual. So I'll stop at that point. There's lots more to be said.
Thanks very much, Morten. We'll have the panel discussion shortly, and we'll be able to go into all those flags that you've mentioned. Thanks very much. That was a really, really good presentation. Yeah. We'll now move on to Julie Bajic's presentation. Julie, our psychologist.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael. Firstly, what I'd like to do is define what is depression and how is it different in older people. What we know is that depression presents in four different types of symptoms. We've got feeling symptoms, physical, behavioural and thinking. With older people, they tend to present with more physical symptoms as opposed to younger people. With the feeling symptoms, they might become irritable, which Eddie appears to be, overwhelmed, lacking confidence and reports of anxiety. In terms of physical symptoms, it could be appetite changes, which we've noted through his decreased appetite, weight loss, reports of pain and multiple physical symptoms. So in my experience, I've seen a number of people who are depressed who are more comfortable saying that they have pain rather than they feel depressed. Behaviourally, they're usually enjoyable activities, they're slowing down movement. And they're thinking, they tend to have memory problems, negative thinking patterns, which can lead to suicidal ideation. It is important to note that depression is essentially the same disorder across the lifespan. It's not just that with older people, it tends to present differently than in younger people. Overall, older people tend to describe sadness a lot less than younger people, and it can be difficult for older people to accept the diagnosis of depression. When we look at the risk factors, it is important to note that age itself is not a risk factor. However, risks increase with social isolation. And isolation is a big, big issue, not only for people who live rurally, but also in metropolitan areas. A number of clients I see particularly who receive home and care packages. The home care worker might be the only person they speak with that day or that week. Grief and loss, so accumulation of losses. So I know Eddie is grieving the loss of his wife. Also loss of identity and loss of purpose. Changes in living arrangements, chronic illness, chronic pain, as well as looking at the possibility of dementia. What we touched on briefly before were the barriers and risks that people are prepared to, the families prepared to tolerate at this time for their loved one. Certainly the risk of malnutrition, the risk of safety, and barriers to treatment become an issue. In relation to looking at it from a psychological perspective, it's really important to note that depression in older people in the community is estimated to be between 10 and 30%, as opposed to general population, which is about 15%. So older people are twice as likely than general population to develop depressive symptoms. In residential care, it tends to go up to 50%. In relation to screening for dementia, which Henry will touch on after me, it's really important to get the baseline, and baseline means to assess what was Eddie like before his wife's death? What was he like before he had a fall? What was his life like when he was bird watching and engaging in activities? It can be particularly difficult in identifying depression and dementia, and we know that people who have early signs of Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia are at greatest risk and have the most disabling depression, and that is particularly if they have insight into the illness and they know what is ahead for them. Older men aged 85 plus have the highest rates of suicide in the population, and that's really surprising for a lot of people because they anticipate that would be in younger age groups. So we're not talking about the numbers, we're talking about the rates. So men aged 85 plus are the highest risk, followed by men aged 8 to 84. This was published by Australian Bureau of Statistics last year. In this stage, it makes sense to look at, well, what is happening? Why are older people not accessing mental health support? And why do we have such a high prevalence of suicide? And the answer comes down to the fact that less than 25% of older people access mental health support at some stage in their life, which is alarming given that in general population, it's more than 50%. So what tends to happen, and particularly in my private practice, is that I would get a referral for a person and I would see on the referral that they have depression, and that would be identified by the GP and the family. But the older person themselves might not think that they are depressed, or they might feel stigma associated with a label of mental illness. So there are a number of barriers to treatment. It could be the client, it could be the family. The family might say, we do not wish for our loved one to receive mental health service support. They might not see that as a barrier. It could be a GP as well. The GP might not perceive that psychological support is required for the person, as well as the access to service. So there aren't many psychologists who work with older population or specialise in working with older population. So what I'm doing at the moment is supervising a group of students through Macquarie University and training them to work with older people, particularly in aged care. Here are a number of screening tools used for depression in older people. These are often administered by GPs or also by psychologists, as well as aged care facilities. In my experience, I have not noted them administered by home care service providers, and certainly through my PhD research, I have learned that mental health is not routinely screened in clients receiving home and community services. I'm not saying that it is a role of home and community service providers to treat mental health, but I think it's important for them to note any changes and to escalate it with the GP appropriately. So we've got a number of tools here which are specifically designed for older people, which include the geriatric depression scale, This is a self-administered 30-item scale, geriatric anxiety inventory, which was developed in Australia in 2007. The Cornell scale for depression and dementia, which is used predominantly in residential care, as well as the brief assessment schedule depression cards. So based on these screening tools, based on the clinical presentation that the client might discuss with their GP or the family, that is usually when my services would become involved. In terms of treatment, we know that older people respond well to psychotherapy. I certainly would expect Eddie would respond well to it. And we found that our research shows that the best treatment is combination of physical activity and cognitive behavioural therapy. We also know that interpersonal therapy is another type of intervention for older people, and that psychosocial interventions can improve well-being and can be effective for depression in older people. That's all I had to say at this stage. I'm conscious of time, and I'll be quite happy to pass it on to Henry.
Thank you very much, Judy. That was a very succinct but very, very complete overview of Eddie's case. And I have been asked by the webinar Hi Honchos just to ask you to stop moving around so much.
Okay.
You're so much into your presentation that with the small screen, you do bob around a little bit, but
okay.
Please don't let that cramp your style.
Okay.
Thanks very much. And now we'll just move on to Henry, Professor Henry Brodesy.
Thanks very much, Michael, and thanks, Julie, for that summary. That's really good. So if we just review Eddie's symptoms of depression, and these fit into the categories that we just heard about. He's irritable, he's complaining, he's lost interest. He's withdrawn socially, he's not eating his meals, his dog is neglected, and in hospital he was restless at night and agitated. When I'm seeing someone with depression, the first thing I want to know is this the first onset or is this a late onset? Because if it's early onset, and we find that out by looking at past psychiatric history, if there's a family history of psychiatric illness, it's more likely to come on early. And I particularly always ask about alcohol and drug history. But if this is the first onset, if Eddie's never had a depression before, then I think, well, could this be an organic cause? Could there be something physically going on with him? And as Julie's explained, neurological disorders have very high rates of depression associated with it. So Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, vascular dementia, stroke. Anyone who's got any neurological condition affecting the brain is at a high risk for depression, maybe up to 50%, say in Parkinson's. But there are other things, with some of which are treatable, and some of which the depression won't get better unless the physical cause is addressed first. Things like having a tumour. It could be a tumour in the brain, but it can be a non-metastatic manifestation of tumour somewhere else in the body. A classic example in the textbooks is cancer of the head of the pancreas. So that people may have the depression a year before the tumour is recognised. I had a patient who had hypercalcemia due to a parathyroid tumour, and he'd had a year or two of treatment before we found his calcium was high, found it was caused by the parathyroid, removed the parathyroid, calcium came down, and he responded then to treatment for his depression. Less commonly, low B12 levels or some infection can be an occult infection. Hypothyroidism, and you can get depression as a side effect of drugs. Moving on, so when I'm seeing a patient with depression, I use this framework. I use it to derive an etiological map. What is the cause of this person's depression now? And so I think of what's happening in the biological sphere, and I've gone through that, the psychological, the interpersonal, and the socio-environmental. So if you look at Eddie, you start from the inside out, as it were, the biological things. He's got pain, he's had a fall, and you question head injury, but the scans have been negative, but still, there may be a late sequelae of that. Is this a medication he's taking? Is this an early dementia that hasn't been diagnosed? Could it be secondary to one of the physical causes I mentioned? I guess most prominent and most obvious in Eddie's case is his grief. I mean, he's angry and maybe even feels guilty about his wife having gone into hospital and his loneliness. The interpersonal domain, he's lost support. He hasn't got his partner. His daughter's in Adelaide. Tom's there. But he doesn't have much in the way of support, particularly as he's withdrawn. And in the socio-environmental, he doesn't seem to have a role in life. He's withdrawn socially. He doesn't have any purpose. So what I would do would be to get a history. I get it from the daughters, and I've said, there should be sister-in-law there. I'd like to know more about his relationship with his wife, because we know if relationships were conflicted before death, the grief is always more complicated. Was he dependent on her? What was going on beforehand? He clearly needs to have a physical examination and a cognitive examination. Remembering the many mental states, that's a reasonable test, but it doesn't do well for frontal lobe function. And so as a minimum, I do a clock drawing test as well, ask them to put in the hands and the numbers for the hours, and then put in the hands for something like 10 past 11 or 20 past 5. I check his weight. Looks like he might be losing weight. I do some basic investigations as listed on that slide. And importantly, this man is at risk of suicide. It's just been highlighted. Older men with depression, we really worry. Has he had thoughts of death? Is he drinking more? Has he thought about how to end it all? Religious practice can sometimes be a savior, can be some sort of safety against it. It's certainly not an absolute safety, but we should ask about that. If I'm the new person coming in for his treatment, I need to build a relationship with Eddie, explore his feelings, and of course deal with the pain which has been spoken about. One of the common conundrums is this depression or is this dementia? I only allowed one slide for this, but I could have had three slides. So just looking at the two, the left is depression and the right is dementia. So the course of the symptoms in depression is usually weeks, rarely months, or less commonly months. In dementia, it's mostly years, sometimes months, unless it's sudden onset like after a stroke. The memory problems in depression are more patchy and may be linked to emotional content, whereas in dementia, it's more short-term memory. Concentration can be down in both, but more so in depression. Past history of psychiatric illness is a really good clue. And the mood in someone with depression is pretty pervasive, and it may have an early morning awakening, maybe a sort of a diurnal mood variation, and worse in the morning, but it's more variable in dementia. There are vegetative features of depression, early morning awakening, diurnal mood variation, loss of weight, loss of appetite. And in dementia or any organic brain syndrome, people tend to get more confused in the evening. We should do cognitive testing, and the person with depression will give up easily. I can't do it. I'm losing my thoughts, my brain. The person with dementia often delights if they get tests right. But there's a trap. People can have both depression and dementia. About 20% of people with Alzheimer's also have a depression. So let's go to management. This has to be a partnership. It has to be the GP, the community services, the family, and at the center of it all, of course, is the patient. Timing's important. Now, I don't think we can do much with Eddie unless he's had time to ventilate and deal with his grief. He's not going to re-engage with his bird watchers or his friends or doing his activities until we do that. The easiest thing is to reach for the antidepressants, but this is not the first line of treatment, and that should be kept in reserve if other things aren't happening. So let's look at this etiological map and now put a management map. So we start with the biological. We're relieving the pain, correct anything that's abnormal, certainly worry about his nutrition, keep the antidepressants on in our back pocket ready for use. Grief counselling, as I said, is really the mainstay at the beginning, I think, and more support for him. Perhaps link him up with, we should link him up with some more supports in his interpersonal life. I've changed that there, sorry. And in the socio-environmental sphere, more community supports, making sure he's eating, somebody coming around to check on him, using the community nurse if it's available, collaborating with a sister-in-law, not the aunt, sorry. And really looking at a stepwise re-engagement and perhaps even organising a pleasurable event schedule, this is the sort of thing Julie would do, that, you know, you start off with a very simple activity that you know he'd like, and have maybe half a dozen activities that he agrees that he used to like when he was well, and then start at the easiest and build up gradually. And that's the end of my session. Thank you very much.
Henry, that was, as many of the attendees have said, that they just love going to your, listening to your talks, and that's the first talk I've heard of yours, and it was absolutely excellent. I learned so much from it, and I'm amazed that you got through it in 7 or 8 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
Now we come to the second part of our presentation, where we discuss collaboration as a panel. And we do have some questions that we want to ask each other on the panel. And Morten, I'll ask you to direct that question we discussed earlier for Sharon in relation to family dynamics. Would you be able to discuss that with Sharon now?
Yeah, sure. Sharon, it's clear that families are really important in this process. How can we best approach families? Who is the best person to take the lead in that when the patient is clearly in trouble and not sure where to turn? Is there any rules that are needed in here?
I think it's really useful to ask the older person who they think their carer is, or if they have anybody that supports them. Because
yeah.
I speak to a lot of carers and they'll say, oh, but the person I care for, they don't think I'm their carer. So it's very useful to hear what they have to say. If they don't think they have a carer, and again, carer is a silly sort of word when it comes to family. It might be just, have you got anybody that supports you? Have you got anyone that you see every week? And that way you can find out from them. I'd then see if you can say to the, ask the older person if you can actually talk to the carer. And this starts that communication that's really very, very useful in the family. Sometimes it's thrown at you if they're in hospital as a carer and a family. It's usually the person who the health professionals see. So that becomes you're the carer. But it's not necessarily always the case. Sometimes the person as the main support for the person might just not be at the hospital or might not be available at that time. So it's really very, very useful to start the conversation, I think, with the older person. If they're confused or, in my mother's case, at one point she was quite psychotic. So, you know, it's really about them being able to talk to the people that are there. And some of the information that was mentioned tonight, particularly by Henry, was superb to be able to actually work out what is wrong with the person and perhaps ask what their history is. Bit about the what religion they had resonated with me, because there were some assumptions made, for example, with my mother, that she was a fundamentalist Christian and she wasn't. So unless you get that information from the family, it can actually help with, I think, the health professionals being able to better diagnose what's going on.
Thank you very much, both of you. We did have a number of questions that came up, but one in particular caught my eye earlier on from Edward Reed, and he was, I'd just like the panel's opinion on this, patient autonomy versus what we as health professionals feel the patient needs. Could I address that to Henry first, and then we'll the panel can then jump in after that.
Yeah. This is a really tough one. Autonomy versus beneficence. Beneficence doing what's beneficial for the patient. So, and I work a lot in the field of dementia, so we're always considering this. You know, sometimes, you know, has the patient lost the capacity to make decisions for themselves, or are they irrational in their thinking, so they're a danger to themselves? this can be really tough, and there's no clear line here. It's a matter of clinical judgment and also talking to the patient and the family. Sometimes it is black and white. You know, if they're suicidal, if they've stopped eating and drinking, if they're not able to care for themselves and the house is squalid, then you have more authority to take charge. But there's always a legal framework. We can't take a person's rights away from them without going through a legal framework. So in the mental health arena, we go through, in New South Wales, the Mental Health Tribunal, or if the person is mentally impaired, with dementia, say, then we go through the Guardianship Tribunal. So there's always a legal framework. Unless there's an urgency about the thing, then you have a duty of care to take over.
Thank you, Henry. Julie, can I ask your opinion on this?
Yeah, sure. Look, I agree with Henry, and it comes up to, you know, individual's preference. You can't force an individual to engage in services if clearly they don't want to, and therefore that's why the interdisciplinary approach is so important. So I think for case of Eddie, looking at other ways that he could connect with people and keep his isolation to a minimum would be a way to get in, you know, obviously, first of all, engaged and make sure that he eats properly and that he's, you know, taking dog for a walk and doing things before we look at any behavioural or therapeutic interventions.
Thank you very much. Morton?
Yeah, look, I would say that it's a really good framework that's been discussed. I think one of the other challenges is, and from Eddie's perspective, he's actually got quite a supportive family that's involved with him. On the other side of the coin, and I see this from time to time, there are some older people who are very much on their own, with very little in the way of social support, even though they have relatives close by. And one of the difficulties that I've found in the past is, how do you engage the family who, for one reason or another, don't want to engage in the process of helping their elderly relative, even if that elderly relative actually wants help? So that's another side of the coin that we need to deal with sometimes. It's not easy.
Thanks, Morton. Sharon, I'm sure you would have some opinions on this.
Yes, look, it can be really hard for the family and the older consumer. It can be a very confusing time for everybody. But when the older consumer might need to be, for example, discharged from hospital, and you can get varying advice from different health professionals, which is the best pathway for the person to return home. And maybe that's something like rehabilitation or something that they might need to so that their physical health can actually improve enough, might not be available. And so returning home is unsafe. Living with the relatives might be, because of family history and family dynamics, may be impossible to actually be able to live with the family. And so residential aged care can be an option. It's a difficult time. It's a difficult time to be able to resolve what is best for the older consumer and for the family.
Thanks very much, Sharon. One of the things that impressed me about his story was his anger. And Elena Di Giacomo, one of our participants, brought up the in her comments brought up the anger towards the treating staff. I mean, how do we deal with that anger, apart from interrogating it's what's causing it? How do we actually deal with it? Julie, starting off with you, do you have any thoughts on that?
Sorry, can you repeat the question, Michael?
When a patient or a client like Eddie is extremely angry towards medical staff, towards carers, towards people who are trying to help him, apart from diagnosing him in general, how does one deal with that anger when he's angry towards medical people? He may see Morton as an enemy as much as the hospital.
Yes, okay. That is very common. I think it needs to be acknowledged, and it is the accumulation of grief and loss that they've had, you know. So it would not be normal to you know, to say, you know, you should like all your doctors and you should like everyone, you know, and appreciate, you know. The big thing that comes up a lot for what I hear is that, you know, oh, you should be appreciative that I'm doing this for you, or that I'm helping you, and that I'm making you, you know, fresh meals. So anger is a normal part of grieving, and I think it really needs to be acknowledged.
And his grief, could you expand on that a little bit?
Okay, and his grief, the accumulation of his grief. So obviously, we don't look at grief as an illness straight away. A person is, you know, it's a normal part of the process. It's for 6 months for a person to grieve before they would be classified as having complex grief. So it is about looking at ways to get him engaged and to get him involved in activities. So with grief, it does take time, and obviously it is something that, you know, waking up next to his wife for, you know, 60-odd years and her not being there, you can't say, well, that's normal, you shouldn't feel, you shouldn't feel grief, you shouldn't miss her. It is more about trying to build on new activities and new routines that would help him through the process.
Well, could I throw open the questions of grief and anger and depression to the rest of the panel now? And again, once they've spoken, back to you, Julie, please.
Yeah.
So, will any of the panel have any thoughts on that?
Sure.
Henry speaking. I agree with Julie. Grief is a normal part of dealing with death, and it's an important process to go through. We shouldn't medicalise it. It's only when it becomes incapacitating or when it's prolonged beyond whatever normal is, and for some people it's a few months and some people it's a year, but when it's getting beyond that, then maybe more interventions are required. Generally what we do is we get the person to talk about the person that has died and about their feelings. And I don't do grief counselling, but there are people who are specialised in that.
Morton?
Yeah, look, I think it's to me the main thing is actually to acknowledge that they've had a rough time, and that it is okay to feel let down, and not to understand what went on. If I was the practitioner who actually was involved in the difficulties with his wife and the complications that went on, acknowledging that, you know, some of the things might have been done differently may be appropriate. But essentially, if you are one step removed from that, and that is in fact the core part of what's keeping him in that space, actually starting to try and work with him about, well, you know, let's look to make sure that the best possible care is got for you, and that you're able to move forward and help you as a person to make sure that we get the most out of it for you. Generally is fairly successful in moving them a little bit further down the track, then involving people in terms of a psychologist or another appropriate counsellor And often somebody with OT skills or social work skills in that setting, depending on what's available in your local area, can be a real big bonus.
Thanks very much, Morten. Now, rather than asking you to comment on that, Sharon, unfortunately, we're coming again towards the end of this webinar. They seem to go by so quickly. So I'm going to start off with you, Sharon, and just give you 2 minutes to sum up on whatever, on your presentation or on the evening or on just your thoughts in general for 2 minutes, and then we'll go through each one of the panel for 2 minutes after that. Each.
Thanks, Michael. Look, I've really enjoyed, this is my first webinar I've been involved with, and so I've been really impressed. I've been watching some of the chats, even though I haven't really been able to respond to anything there. I had my eye on everything, but what I found that Henry's presentation was really great for me, because I've had my mother-in-law with Alzheimer's, my mother had bipolar disorder, and that differentiation between the depression and dementia was really very, very good. One thing I would throw in the mix would be around delirium and when is psychosis. So when is a delirium and when's a psychosis just that, and how that's treated. But that might be for another time. Big issue with older people too, I think.
Thanks very much, Sharon, and thank you very much for your contribution tonight. Now we'll move on to Morten. Just 2 minutes, thanks, Morten.
No worries, Michael. Look, very succinctly, I think that the big issue for GPs is information, and certainly we want to be contacted in terms of if there are concerns, if there are things that other counsellors, other people involved with our patients think we should know, let us know so that we can help. We do see ourselves as the linchpin, as the coordinating activator in this. So that's the key thing, communication and letting us know where we can help.
Thanks very much, Morten. Of course, MHPN is all about collaboration, and I think all of the speakers this evening have stressed that, and it's just I feel quite humbled just being here tonight. Now we'll move on to Julie. 2 minutes.
Thanks, Michael. What I haven't had a chance to touch on yet is limited input that psychologists really have in gerontology due to partially funding. And I've noted a number of comments on the discussion board about engaging other types of therapy, including reminiscence therapy and including narrative therapy. So it really depends what setting the psychologist works in private practice. If we receive referral through Better Access to Mental Health, it has to be evidence-based psychotherapy. It's looking at CBT, having a maximum of 10 sessions in a calendar year, even though they're looking at increasing it up to 12 as of 1st of July. So you really need to prioritise what are you assisting a client with. And grief and loss is a major part of what it is going through. So part of that is, you know, providing psychoeducation, normalising, allowing space for grief, hope and reassurance, but also working towards establishing some goals. At this stage, you know, reminiscence therapy could be beneficial, but I think that there are other priorities that he needs to address at this point of time. Thanks, Michael.
That's fine, Judy. I'd just like you to expand on that, because I did notice that there were a lot of questions, a lot of comments around that. Could you just expand on that, on the therapies available for this age group with mental health?
So the main ones, well, as I said, they are governed by Medicare. So when you receive a referral from a doctor, if it is through Medicare, it needs to be evidence-based psychotherapy. And at this stage, it's it's predominantly cognitive behavioural therapy because older people respond to it quite well. There's a growing trend of looking at reminiscence therapy. There's some work certainly done down in Melbourne by Sunil Bayo in terms of reminiscence and engaging. So with reminiscence therapy, there's two types. There's the life review and reminiscence therapy. So reminiscence therapy doesn't necessarily need to look at all stages of life, but engaging the person with what, you know, what are the happy memories, or even if they've had some challenges, how they have overcome them in their life. Unfortunately, that doesn't fall under Medicare referral, so you would not be able to engage in that therapy under a scheme that allows a rebate for a client. Reminiscence therapy has been found to be effective with people with dementia. Then again, you know, if people do enter residential care, a number of them are not eligible to better access to mental health rebates. So a psychologist really does have a number of barriers to treating this population, and it really depends what setting they work in. In my experience, there's only one or two residential aged care facilities which employ psychologists who would have the privilege of being able to look at alternative therapies. But certainly for me as a psychologist visiting people in their homes, I am quite limited in terms of what intervention I can provide under the type of referral that I receive.
Thanks very much, Julie. Henry, we'll let you sum up
that. Michael. So one of the things I didn't mention in the grief counselling is Eddie's angry, and his anger at the doctors is something that needs to be explored as well, you know, losing his wife unexpectedly. And I think we've touched on that, but I would emphasise it. One of the issues I haven't discussed is when should you refer? What's the threshold for referral? Now, most of this will be dealt with in primary care. It won't go to specialist practice. So the issues are for referral is severity. So if it's at the point where the person, as I said, is not eating or drinking or is suicidal. Chronicity, so it's not getting better despite everything you're throwing at. Or risk. If the person's at an acute risk, then you can't wait. So they're the usual indications for referral. Well, sometimes, you know, you as the GP or as the nurse in the community, or the social worker has been doing the counselling, just throw up your arms and you say, look, I've really worked very hard with Eddie, but I'm not getting anywhere and so need a second opinion. So that's the main thing I want to say. The other thing is that, Michael, you told us that there's a little clue in the text here that I'll leave to you to deal with let people know about. I think that's an interesting one. I missed it.
Yes, if everybody goes back to Eddie's case history, sorry, I've had the misfortune to do a writing workshop recently, and I've been practicing my skills on MHPN, and I just want to ask you all why you think Eddie goes to the dump once a week and what he's bringing to the dump that nobody else knows he's bringing to the dump. Somebody did mention earlier that it was bodies, but I don't think it is bodies. So, we have come to the end of another session with MHPN. I always learn lots and lots of things from facilitating for MHPN, and certainly tonight has been one of those nights. I would encourage participants who know each other to set up your own special interest networks or to join an existing one in your area. Remember that all of the PowerPoints and all of the Eddie's story, if you have mislaid it, they will all be available on the website from tomorrow. And please, I would encourage collaboration between all the disciplines. Not just the disciplines who were present tonight, but we must remember our social work colleagues, our mental health nurses, our occupational therapists, physiotherapists. As Julie stressed continuously, physical health is a major cause of psychological and mental deterioration in elderly people, lack of physical health. The things that came through to me tonight were the the, you know, the normality and abnormality of grief, and perhaps his grief is quite abnormal at the moment. The problems that we all have with funding and who pays for these services, and how do we get a guy like Eddie to access the proper services. The element of risk is certainly there with Eddie, and he certainly sounds as if he's becoming quite depressed with his abnormal grief. The aspect of his carers and possible carer fatigue and possibly lack of support of carers is important. I wasn't aware of reminiscence therapy, and I will be accessing Dr. Google at the end of this session to read up about reminiscence therapy. Thank you, Julie. And also, I was very interested in the responses to how to deal with his anger, and I don't think there is really any one good way, and I think just being empathic. Also, the issues that arise in relation to autonomy and beneficence, as Henry so eloquently expanded on, you know, the Georgetown principles of ethical management of patients and clients are quite important. And lastly, when to refer to each other. When does Henry refer to a GP? When does the GP refer to a psychologist? And perhaps in the future we will have carer advocates with the expertise of Sharon, whom we can access with de-identified data to get their opinions as to what we should do. So before I finish, I would like to invite all participants to, I think at the height we had something like 721 people on board tonight. I would like to ask all the participants to join future MHPN webinars, and particularly the next one, which is supporting the well-being of people experiencing a trauma response, which is on the 2nd of June. And of course, details of that are available on the MHPN website. Before I close, I'd like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who've lived with mental illness in the past, and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. And I would like to sincerely thank you, everyone, our very talented panel, and our very committed participants, for your participation this evening, and I trust I will see you all again some evening in the future. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night, panel.
Good night.